Welcome. Inside Appalachia, I'm Jessica Lilly. On this show, we try to bring you stories and reports that make you feel something. Anything from joy to compassion to inspiration or even motivation. We look and work hard to tell stories that matter, and most importantly, matter to you. While mining for that quality audio, we found a lot of stories worth sharing, but they never quite fit onto our show. We didn't have to look very hard to find people who take pride in their work to tell meaningful and impactful stories about Appalachians. But you don't have to take our word for it. West Virginia Public Broadcasting was recently recognized by two journalism organizations, folks who know responsible and quality storytelling. So on today's show, we're celebrating our team. It's an opportunity to bring you some of those great stories worth sharing. West Virginia Public Broadcasting won 6 regional Edward R. Murrow Awards. The awards are given by an organization called the Radio Television Digital News Association that honors outstanding achievements in electronic journalism. The organization is also dedicated to remembering Edward Murrow, a journalist from the 50s. Here's one of the stories that got an Edward R. Murrow Award. It's about the declining coal industry. According to the U.S. Energy Information Administration, coal production from this past year was expected to be the lowest level since 1986. Thousands of miners have lost their jobs since March 2012. West Virginia has long relied on the industry for jobs and tax revenue. Some families are going out of state to find work, but sometimes that doesn't even work out. Here's Ashton Mara's award-winning report from August of last year. The report explores how the declining demand for coal is playing out in the state.
The unincorporated town of Comfort, West Virginia, is made up of 2 gas stations and an elementary school. All 3 sit along a winding 2-lane road that on any given day is peppered with trucks carrying loads of coal. Coal they picked up at the Canal Eagle Mining Complex a few hundred feet down the road. But the last several years have been tough for the industry, and now fewer and fewer of those trucks roll through.
Sometimes I wonder how they even make money.
31-year-old Derek Chase has worked in the industry for nearly a decade. He stopped at one of the Comfort gas stations about an hour before his night shift at the Canal Eagle site, where he works as an electrician.
We've been in bankruptcy for probably close to 2 months now.
Earlier this year, Chase's employer, Patriot Coal, filed for bankruptcy, and this month issued notices to some 1,000 employees in southern West Virginia that they could be laid off. But Chase's story isn't unique in Boone County, where he lives and works. The county has lost nearly 2,700 mining jobs since 2011, the highest number of coal job losses for any county in the nation. The decline hasn't just been bad news for miners like Chase, though. Coal is one way local governments in West Virginia pay for things like water lines and senior centers.
All your coal counties are really hurting, southern West Virginia. We're all the same.
Mickey Brown has been a member of the Boone County Commission for 15 years. Brown watched as his county's budget grew in the early part of the decade because of an influx of dollars from coal severance taxes. A severance tax is the rate companies pay for extracting a natural resource in the state. In West Virginia, mining companies pay 5% per ton of coal. But as the price of coal declined over the past several years, Commissioner Brown says so did the amount that Boone County collected. From 2012 to 2015, the county's budget was cut almost in half.
Now, we've made cuts all along to where we've been watching what we've been spending.
And those cuts have come to county services. Boone County prioritizes projects that will bring public drinking water to its rural communities. Instead of paying for it themselves with severance tax dollars, today the county relies on federal and private grants to fund waterline expansions. Those grants can be costly and time-consuming for small governments to apply for and keep track of. Community projects are suffering as well. Commissioner Brown says years ago, the County Board of Education asked for help replacing bleachers at all 3 county high school football stadiums, a $500,000 project. Today, if that project came before the commission, Brown says they'd have to turn them away.
Before, when somebody would come in with a request, it could be an extravagant request, and we could do it. But now we kind of made a policy that we're not going to do any more grants, $1,000 maximum each year.
And the state is starting to feel the pinch, too. Deputy Revenue Secretary Mark Muehkau says back in 2012, coal mining tax revenues made up about 9% of the state's budget.
In the fiscal year 16 budget, we believe it's going to be closer to 5.4%.
Or a decrease of about $150 million. Federal regulations and an abundance of cheaper, cleaner natural gas is hurting the industry, Muehkau says. He also attributes the decline to a decrease in foreign demand. Back in Boone County, where electrician Derek Chase lives, the decline in coal prices is forcing him out of not just the industry, but out of the state altogether. Chase, who has a wife and three young kids, started searching for a job long before his layoff notice came, and he found one outside of Albany, New York, some 650 miles away from home.
Got to work somewhere, and there's not going to be any place to work here.
Still, coal is following him. His new job with CSX would have had him working on locomotive engines, but it's been put on hold because of a decline in rail shipments of coal. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Ashton Mara in Comfort, West Virginia.
That story won a regional Murrow Award in the category of hard news issues. West Virginia competed with news organizations from throughout Kentucky, North Carolina, South Carolina, and Tennessee. This report and all of the other regional winners move on to the national competition. Those winners will be announced in June. Now, we really don't like to brag, but being recognized by these organizations means more folks are likely to hear Appalachia's story. So I guess it's worth mentioning that this show, Inside Appalachia, was recognized for Best News Documentary. The episode just so happened to be one of our favorite shows from last year. You might remember the show called What Happens When Strangers Take Our Picture. Let's listen now to the first part of that episode. Today we're exploring just what happens to communities when strangers come to photograph Appalachia. It's a topic that you might have strong feelings about. It's complicated. It's also not new. Hearing about recent clashes between outsider photographers and local people, it almost seems as if we've been through this before.
She said the reason it made me so mad was because I thought they was taking them pictures to make us look bad in this area. That's one of the things that they caused him to blow up.
This is an excerpt from a film called Stranger with a Camera. It's about how back in 1967, a man in eastern Kentucky killed a photographer. On our show today, we're talking about how people in Appalachia react to photographers who want to document our lives. Sometimes we can get pretty defensive. The documentary filmmaker who made Stranger with a Camera talks about that. Her name is Elizabeth Barrett, and she grew up near where the shooting happened.
I grew up in a place inundated with picture takers of the creeks, the hollows, the houses, and the people of Appalachia. I didn't think much about it back then. After all, what did those images have to do with me? What is the difference between how people see their own place and how others represent it? Who does get to tell the community's story? And what are the storyteller's responsibilities?
Barrett recounts how, during the war on poverty, lots of photographers and news people came to this region. People who lived here wound up being subjects of stories about how desperately poor parts of Appalachia were. A number of photographers and filmmakers were sent to Appalachia to specifically document the poverty of the region. Let's listen to one of these pieces. This one is from a CBS special documentary by Charles Kuralt, produced with the help of the Office of Economic Opportunity in 1965.
This is the road, if you can call it that, that leads to the Pert Creek School in Letcher County, Kentucky. There are tens of thousands of roads like this, winding back along the creeks and hollows of 11 states. And beside these roads, the shacks of tar paper and pine, which are the homes of a million permanently poor.
Some people in Appalachia have gotten pretty tired of this portrayal. In today's show, we're going to talk about some of the questions Elizabeth Barrett raises in her film. Who gets to take our pictures? Who gets to tell our story? What's the right way to photograph a community? We'll hear from some Appalachian photographers, writers, and social media experts, and we'll talk with the person who has been on the other side of the camera. The shooting in Jeremiah, Kentucky happened almost 50 years ago, but in some ways, things really haven't changed. And many of us are still defensive. Some people feel as though the media has been portraying us as a sideshow ever since the war on poverty. Two events that happened this year have reignited these feelings against outsider photographers. Recently, a photo essay in Vice magazine showed some startling images of Appalachians, and we're going to explore that piece more in just a bit. But first, let's return to an incident that happened back in March, when two photographers visited McDowell County in southern West Virginia. The county deals with some of the toughest realities in the country, high drug overdose death rates and low income, among other things. The events that unfolded got national attention. Photographer Marisha Camp and her brother Jesse were driving through McDowell County taking pictures. They stopped at a gas station and walked across the street. They came back to find their vehicle was blocked in by a van. The siblings were confronted by angry residents who believed they were taking photos of their children. No one was injured, but Marisha Camp recorded the tense encounter and shared it with photographer Roger May. Let's listen to the recording of that tense interaction between the photographers and the locals. I want to warn you, this next clip contains language that some listeners might find offensive.
No pictures of any children on it.
No, and you can check it.
Not of your kids. I can show you, like, Jesus Christ, we didn't stop and, like, approach, like...
Yeah, you guys are making us out to be, like,
you guys are really making us out to be people that we're not, and,
like... Don't listen to me.
Bring your buddies up here.
Hey!
I can take pictures of kids. Up these hollers.
Why are you taking pictures of kids for?
We are not. We're on vacation. Dude, we take pictures of houses.
You don't even live around here. You don't need to take pictures of even a goddamn rock. Put your camera away.
God damn it, we're on vacation.
Put your camera away. I don't give a damn where you're from.
We were listening to a recorded confrontation that took place in McDowell County back in March. Marisha Camp and her brother Jesse said they were traveling through the area and didn't intend to take photos of children without their parents' permission. The police were called to break up the argument. What can explain a group of people reacting so negatively to a stranger taking a few pictures? Well, to get a bit of an insider's perspective from someone who's born and raised in McDowell County, where the incident took place, we decided to talk with Sabrina Schrader. You might remember Sabrina, who's been on Inside Appalachia in the past. She grew up poor in a home filled with domestic violence. Sabrina first shared her story on public radio back in September 2013, but before that, she spoke on behalf of Child Law Services. The organization represented her and asked her to speak at an event as a success story. The local TV station was there, and Sabrina wound up in a story. She knows what it's like to be embarrassed by the images of herself selected by the media.
I was put on the news, and they had me crying, and they had said some things that I didn't tell them on the news episode, and I felt completely humiliated, and it was my first time speaking in public in the news, and I'd been taught not to do that. I was told that they would make me look bad, never tell anyone that you're poor, they'll make fun of you, and I understood why I was taught not to do that. However, after that aired, I vowed that I would never speak to the news again. And not even a week later, I got a phone call that a couple teenagers who came from similar situations as I have been, I'm the first person in my family to graduate high school. They hadn't had anyone in their family graduate high school or go to college, and they said they didn't know they could go, and because they knew that I went, they were going to go. So I said, well, if anybody else asks me to speak, I guess I'll be the poster child for poverty. And that's basically what's happened.
Sabrina remembers hearing about the clash between photographers and locals in McDowell County in March. She still has some strong feelings about it.
I really thought it was shameful. They did not have a relationship with anybody in the community, and no one knew who they were. And, you know, we don't have kids yet, but if anybody even takes a picture of my dog without my permission, I'm going to be upset because it's my dog and or my home. I don't care if they're allowed to take pictures on public property. You know, people are not public property.
Well, and why do you have such strong feelings about this? Where do you think this comes from?
Of being criticized throughout my whole life in pictures or at school or at work, constant criticism of how I'm supposed to look, how I'm supposed to talk, what's right, what's wrong, do it this way, do it that way. That's partly what it stems from. And then being someone who grew up living in generational poverty, in my family and the whole McDowell County, I just don't think it's ethically right or moral to go take pictures of people without their permission, especially children.
A lot of people say that this is, you know, obviously the parents in McDowell County felt strongly about it, had similar feelings like you. There have been other incidents, one in Kentucky, as a matter of fact, where an individual photographer was actually killed by a Kentucky resident because they were taking pictures of their property. So obviously there's some really strong emotions. Again, where do you think these feelings come from, of distrust from photographers and taking these pictures and these images? How have Appalachians been portrayed in the media?
The feelings come from being oppressed. In the media, they're portrayed as and labeled as at risk, uneducated, resistant to learning. I mean, they think we're all dumb and that we don't want better, that we're lazy. You know, I feel sorry for the photographer and you know, that was killed. I don't think that's right. I don't think we should be a bunch of vigilantes. However, if you're put in that situation, what are you going to do? Are you going to do something? Or are you going to call a police officer who may be 2, 3, 4, 5 hours away and wait on them to come and help you? No, if you're wanting to protect your children and protect your property and what you have, then you're going to call your neighbors and say, hey, something doesn't look right out here, and let's go see what's going on.
And what would you say to the critics out there that said that the way that the citizens in McDowell County acted was embarrassing and they were embarrassed of the people that acted that way?
I think that you're not understanding where these people are coming from, that you're not putting yourself in their situation. And apparently you must not understand what it means to be oppressed, what it means to have to work for something that is never yours, to live in coal camp houses that are not yours, and to have to pay for them, and to have to pay for things that coal mine owners owned. They own our mountains, they own our land, and they own our people. We have been slaves to rich people, to rich men in Appalachia. We've been slaves to what they want because we want to provide for our families. When I see pictures of people going to church being portrayed in a negative manner, or pictures of children who are overweight being taken pictures of those, it just makes me so sad because these kids are getting judged, and so are their families, when people who are living in poverty-stricken areas have what you call food deserts, and they have to eat whatever there is there, and whatever is the cheapest, and healthiest food is not the cheapest.
Yeah, let's get into that a little bit. There was an article in Vice called 2 Days in Appalachia, and there were children pictured in that, and There were senior citizens, it seemed, and elderly individuals photographed, and there was some pretty strong reaction from a lot of people within the Appalachian community and in the media to those pictures. What was your reaction to those pictures?
I was upset by them, and I was offended. Some of the comments that were said to me were, oh, we see people like this all over the world or all over the country. And it's like, well, even if you do, why is it that the low-income Appalachians are the ones that they take pictures of and say, this is 2 days in Appalachia? That's not what 2 days in Appalachia looks like or feels like to me. I do go to church, and I myself am overweight right now. And if I had pictures of me taken as a child of where I was overweight, I mean, that could potentially cause children, I would have wanted to kill myself. I mean, I was bullied and everything else, but if somebody would have taken pictures of me and put them in the news, I mean, what is going to happen to these children that they took pictures of?
Is there anything else that you want to add about images in Appalachia? Being a person that is familiar and has lived through generational poverty.
When a reporter or news person, this is advice I have to give to you all. When you decide that you want to do a story or a news article or whatever art form you want to call it in the media about people who are either low income or living in poverty or have in Appalachia, you should develop a compassionate relationship with the people that you're going to do stories on, and you should make sure that what you're going to say agrees with their perspective and not just what you think it is, because you may be misinformed or misrepresent these people, and misrepresenting these people, it really hurts. It hurts. Like, I'm still hurt over all this, and I'm never going to forget it, so I guess that's why everyone told me to never do this. I'm grateful and glad that I have, because I see it is making a positive difference in many ways.
Sabrina, I'm really thankful that you come back on Inside Appalachia and West Virginia Public Broadcasting, and we certainly treasure your trust. Thanks for being with us again.
Thank you, Jessica. God bless you.
Full disclosure, Sabrina is currently running for a seat in the West Virginia House of Delegates. Again, today on Inside Appalachia, we're hearing stories produced by West Virginia Public Broadcasting that won awards for last year. So far, we've heard a couple of Murrow winners, and when we come back, we're going to hear an investigative report into the effects that abandoned wells are having on some residents' water here in Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. You're Inside Appalachia.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
Thanks for listening to Inside Appalachia. This show is sort of a hodgepodge of topics, but the stories have one thing in common. They're award-winning. We've heard a couple of stories that won an Edward R. Murrow Award. And in this job, let me tell you, we labor behind the microphone and cameras writing stories before we bring them to life with image and sound. This next story won an award for writing. It was also named the best investigative report in both West Virginia and Virginia by the Associated Press, a nonprofit organization that's one of the largest and most trusted sources of independent news gathering. In this story, Glynis Board takes a closer look at a little-known and less-understood effect of the natural gas drilling happening in northern and north-central West Virginia.
When natural gas drillers use extreme pressure to drill and then crack rocks thousands of feet underground, when they frack for natural gas, for example, sometimes nearby conventional wells will suddenly see production double or triple. When drilling processes of a new well affect an already existing one, it's called well communication. Sometimes it's a good thing, but sometimes it isn't. In West Virginia, over 1,500 horizontal wells exist on some 400 well pads. That's in addition to roughly 50,000 conventional wells spread throughout many backyards and hillsides. Then there are another 12,000 that are abandoned. Many of these abandoned wells were drilled prior to 1929. That's when the West Virginia Department of Environmental Protection started to keep track of these things. One thing is fairly certain about all of these wells. They are all conduits underground, and they all cut through the water table. And nowhere is the Swiss cheese that is West Virginia more apparent than in Doddridge County, where gas wells, new and old, are as common as cows.
We are in Doddridge County right now, and that is between Clarksburg and Parkersburg. And we have this road here, but since you can see, it's all just this, most of this traffic is this stuff that's going on now with gas and everything.
Lyndia Ervolina is standing in her front yard, 75 feet or so from Route 50. She's pointing to several heavy trucks passing by.
They're hauling water, they're hauling that sand, they're hauling silica sand, they're hauling frack fluid, they're hauling, you name it, they haul it in and out.
Drill cuttings, heavy machinery, pipe, Ervolina sees it all from her front porch. She's not an industry expert, but she knows what it's like to live surrounded by horizontal drilling operations. Not only is the industry moving around Ervolina on wheels, big gas has moved into Ervolina's yard. Literally. It comes from across the street.
I have a condensate tank up there that they blow off, that they put in when they put the pipeline in. It's a tank that cleans the gas as it goes through to get a lot of the impurities and stuff off of it. And they just blow it off into the air.
The troubling fact is that the smell of treated gas isn't the only indicator of air pollution Ervolina worries about. There's also this noise. Right next to the condensate tank, an abandoned well that was drilled in the 60s is making this noise. The sound you hear is gas venting into the air from some underground rock formation. Neither Ervolina nor the DEP knows who is responsible for it. Ervolina isn't comfortable around this abandoned well, but she did walk me over to it. It's been making this sound for years.
I came out one day and there were pieces of the thing laying all over the place, and it was just pouring gas out.
Ervolina cannot say for sure what happened to this well. There was some pipeline construction in the immediate vicinity, and in the last few years, her area of Doddridge County has seen a lot of fracking, which is when drillers use liquid, sand, and extreme pressure to crack rocks thousands of feet underground.
The casing is gone. I mean, it's completely busted up. So, let's get out of here.
Ervolina says she already gets so much exposure to gas and pollutants from the condensate tank that she doesn't linger for long. Now, untreated natural gas does not have an odor, but there is actual video footage taken with a special filter that clearly reveals this particular abandoned well venting gas. And Ervolina says when nearby horizontal wells are being fracked, the well hiss is louder. The phenomenon Ervolina is describing, when one well affects pressure or production of another well, that's an example of wells communicating, Research on exactly this topic is just getting underway now at a horizontal gas well in Morgantown. Scientists hope to determine if any gas is migrating from the Marcellus Shale rock formation into overlying formations or underground sources of drinking water. One Morgantown scientist, Mark Glass, says the possibility of migrating liquids and gases is something scientists have been concerned about for years.
The process of hydraulic fracturing can, of course, create fractures that intersect an existing well or the fracture network created from another well. So that's by those pathways wells can communicate.
Glass is in charge of the Environmental Monitoring and Remediation Program at Downstream Strategies, the Morgantown-based environmental consulting firm. Like Ervelina and other residents, Glass says he's concerned about potential contamination associated with well communication. He explains that plenty of demonstrations of well communication already exist, but he says predicting how wells will communicate is beyond us. Technology does exist today where, just by listening carefully during the fracking process, we can pinpoint where the rocks underground are cracking. It's called microseismic monitoring. But Glass says even that has limitations.
Microseismic tells you where a fracture has occurred. It does not tell you where the fluid that was required to generate the pressure to make that fracture actually is, was, or will be. It only tells you where there was enough fluid present to make enough pressure to actually induce a fracture.
Antero Resources is a gas company doing a lot of horizontal drilling in the state. Al Shoup is Antero's regional vice president and chief administrative officer. He wasn't comfortable being recorded, but he explained that well communication isn't always a bad thing. Because from an industry perspective, it's an indicator that an area has been thoroughly developed. But it is something Antero operators are also concerned with. He says mostly Antero has safety concerns should older equipment in the area give way under greater pressures. He says it's common for horizontal drillers to map all the wells in the vicinity of their operation. And if they can, his operators try to communicate with any local operators who might be affected by the drilling process. Unfortunately, there's no policy or law where they have to also talk to residents in the vicinity. The West Virginia DEP confirms that there have been at least two incidents where, as a direct result of horizontal drilling activity, conventional gas wells have seen increased pressures. There was an incident in 2012 in Ritchie County, and more recently, after horizontal drilling activity in Ohio, conventional wells were affected on the other side of the Ohio River in West Virginia. DEP says that so long as it doesn't break any equipment, increases in pressure is often a good thing for these conventional gas wells because they see increases in production. But for people living near abandoned wells, it seems more like bad luck.
You know, my house has no value now, and I wonder if I should take what money we have left and invest it in the house or just figure that we might have to move out of here. And I mean, it kind of leaves you just in this limbo. And unfortunately, you know, my husband is, I just turned 67, so my husband's 68, and, you know. It's kind of hard to start over.
The hissing, broken well at Ervelina's house is a conduit for underground pollutants into our atmosphere. The DEP says it should be plugged. That's essentially when you pour cement into the well. As simple as pouring some cement into a hole sounds, DEP officials say that that process costs anywhere from $25,000 to more than $50,000 for each conventional well. Even by conservative estimates, plugging all of the abandoned wells in West Virginia, and remember, there are about 12,000 that we know of, well, that would cost the state around $300 million. And a lot of experts agree that the abandoned wells are hardly the problem when you consider the 50,000 aging conventional gas wells in the state owned and operated by families and small companies who simply do not have the means to plug their wells. The price tag to plug those wells is $1.25 billion. So while the DEP tries to figure out who is responsible for plugging the abandoned well in Doddridge County, the Ervilinas have to continue to deal with the air pollution. But should they also worry about their water? Industry advocates claim that liquid communication between wells is so unlikely that no one needs to worry. But many residents are worried, and many are living with contaminated water as a direct result of horizontal drilling activity.
We're still, there's ethane. Ethane is still in the water. Aluminum is showing up in it. Now, the last test, the arsenic level was down.
Sue Ellen Hill and her husband, Dave, are surface owners in Harrison County who've been living with the reality of horizontal drilling since 2008. A complicated reverse osmosis water system was installed in their home, and every 2 weeks, bottled water is delivered to them after several surface spills contaminated their water well. Their water was not contaminated as a result of well communication, but they are concerned about the threat of contamination throughout the region from conventional gas wells and water wells being pressurized by drilling operations. These concerns rose after witnessing strange and surprising things on their property.
I think when he said 400 or 500 feet, he was exaggerating. Why didn't you just say it was a mile away?
Sue and Dave Hill are walking from the horizontal well pad on their property, about a third of the mile into the woods, to a site of an old South Penn shallow oil well. The well is long retired.
It was probably drilled around 1910. It had been plugged, I'm not sure what date, and we discovered in 2010, I believe it was, or 2011, that this plug was actually blown out of the ground.
The Hills are standing over what is essentially a large concrete cork that's about 4 feet long and 2 feet wide with an old metal casing in the middle. During the drilling process, at some point, there was enough pressure in this old 1910 oil well to blow this 400-pound cement plug completely out of the ground. It's a troubling thought because abandoned and conventional wells can be full of carcinogenic toxins. Their casings that cut through the water table, if they're still intact, are not built for pressures applied in horizontal wells. The Hills have become distrustful after almost a decade of dubious experiences. Still, they don't hate the gas industry. But like the Ervilinas in Doddridge County, the Hills have been exposed to dangerous pollution and witnessed the power of the gas industry on many levels.
I don't want to be a doomsdayer, but I think we have opened up, or our legislature and all of the agencies have opened a Pandora's box of pollution that is really beyond all of our imagination.
The potential for liquids like fracking fluid, drilling mud, or produced water, all laced with toxins, to migrate and contaminate water is largely unstudied today. And again, industry representatives say contamination is highly unlikely. But we're dealing with pressures that can blow large blocks of cement out of the ground. And in an area where geological anomalies and thousands of man-made gas wells and coal mine shafts are common. Many experts admit that these potential conduits pose real threats to the health of watersheds, air, and the people who exist in the vicinity. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Glynis Board in Harrison County.
Next, we're going to hear a short story that our producer Roxy Todd won a meritorious award from the Associated Press. It's a story remembering the Farmington mine disaster that killed 78 men. At the time, it was the worst U.S. mine disaster in 50 years. A memorial service is held every year on the Sunday before the anniversary. Roxy Todd attended the service last year.
So I'm standing here. We're at the memorial of the Farmington mine disaster. We're standing in a field surrounded by trees, most of which have lost their leaves. It's a beautiful sunny day. I'm looking at a crowd of about 150 people here, remembering their family members who died here 47 years ago in 1968.
It was the explosion heard around the world. We'll never forget it. And we'll never forget my dad, David Manila.
This is Aida Manila Everhart. Next, I go speak with a woman who says she was 5 years old when the explosion took place. And would you mind just introducing yourself?
I'm Sharon Clellan. I'm the daughter of David Cartwright. He was 35 when the explosion happened.
Sharon points out that 1 year after the Farmington disaster, Congress passed a Comprehensive Safety Act, which helped protect miners.
If it wasn't for this disaster, the Mine and Safety Act of today probably would not even exist. I have a son that's in the coal mines today. I have a niece that's in the coal mines. Technology of today is 100% better than what it was 47 years ago. Makes it a little bit easier, but you never stop worrying. Never.
For the past 8 years, Sharon has been coming here with her family to sing Amazing Grace at the annual memorial service. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Roxy Todd in Farmington, West Virginia.
May save thus far, and grace will lead me home.
Finally, we end our show with a story that artfully uses sound to take us back in time. Every year, dozens of people in Harper's Ferry recreate Christmas 1864. It's fun for locals and visitors to see how people in the Victorian-era West Virginia celebrated Christmas, but it's also a reminder of how bittersweet life can be for people looking for a bit of good cheer in the midst of a long and terrible war. Liz McCormick brings us this look at a Civil War Christmas.
I'm walking along cobblestone streets in historic Harper's Ferry. It's still 2015, but it sure doesn't feel like it. Most of the buildings around me were built in the 1830s or 1840s. I'm surrounded by reenactors, dressed in Victorian style, women in plaid, poofy dresses, bonnets, and some with green or blue parasols. Some men are in black suits with a top hat. And some patrol the streets, dressed in their Union blues, keeping an eye out for Confederate guerrilla raiders.
My paws lift, charge! One.
There's a blacksmith hammering in the distance. Some Union soldiers are looking for a sweet to eat at the confectionery, or they stop by the provost marshal's office to see if there's a letter or a package from home. A train rumbles by as I walk outside a Union soldier hospital. I'm only brought out of the magic when I see tourists dressed in modern clothes ogling the same scenes I am. I arrive at a large white tent. There's a small stage where two men play on instruments, one on a banjo, and the other taps a beat on a cow jawbone. On either side of the stage are long tables with holiday crafts for children, and in the corner of the tent is a small Christmas tree, decorated with popcorn and cranberry strands.
Mean, but he is in his appropriate blue uniform. Rebels have no space in gingerbread cookies.
22-year-old Colleen Moran stands next to her grandmother, Mary Lou Taylor. They're standing behind one of the tables in Victorian-style plaid dresses. They're decorating gingerbread cookies with visiting children.
There's colored icing and paper faces that you can put on the gingerbread, and the very difficult decision is always deciding whether you should give your gingerbread to the tree or if you should just eat it.
Moran's grandmother tells me how ornaments like the gingerbread cookies used to be the norm during the Civil War.
I explained to the visitors that they did not save ornaments from year to year. They made them fresh every year, and they made them out of things that were available, like nuts and pine cones and things like this. And then they would just throw them out at the end of the year. But during the Civil War, the German soldiers started bringing the glass-blown ornaments from Germany, and they remembered those. And so those became more popular. So it was actually during the Civil War that they started saving the ornaments from year to year.
Taylor and her granddaughter come from a family of history buffs. In fact, Taylor sewed the dresses the two of them are wearing. She's been volunteering at this event for almost 30 years. And for Moran, this is year number 16.
Well, it's very important just historically to this area to remind people of what happened here on this land and this place to the people who are related to a lot of the current residents here. Their great-great-grandfathers or however many greats. They lived and celebrated and died here. There's a lot of memories here, and it's important to remember that.
This is the 45th year for the old-time Christmas event in Harper's Ferry. It's put together by local businesses and the National Park Service, and it always happens the first weekend in December. John King is the supervisory park ranger for the Harper's Ferry National Historical Park.
All the activities here are something that actually happened here, and as much as possible at the original event location where they happened too.
King's colleague, Melinda Day, has left her ranger uniform home today. She's wearing a light green plaid dress, and her hair is pulled back in a low bun, sort of like Mary Todd Lincoln.
Because this is a historical park, and because we do have a rich Civil War history, we focus on the idea that Christmas and war coexist. Almost any visitor that walks into this park understands that someplace in this world, American service people are putting their lives on the line, even though it may be Christmas. And when a visitor steps into this park for a Civil War Christmas, that's the same story and relevance that resonates with them in modern times.
Day says Harper's Ferry was a strategic site in the war. It switched hands 14 times. And in late 1864, things were changing.
The war's coming to an end, and everybody feels that. And you can feel joy while you're feeling pain. I think anybody that's been through something like that could nod their head and say, yes, I understand that. You can actually experience joy when you also experience pain.
Private, I am told there's perhaps a package for me, a box sent from home.
Tom Bates is a reenactor portraying a Union soldier stationed in Harper's Ferry. There's a package waiting for him at the provost marshal's office from his wife. Some Union soldiers check the contents of the box to make sure there isn't any contraband or Confederate propaganda.
Sir, should we let him take the rest of the...
What else do we have here?
It looks like some clothes and packages.
Yeah, clothing is good. Yes, that's all approved. We can approve all that.
Thank you very much.
Bates gets some warm clothes, a welcome reminder of home, especially at this time of year. But it wasn't always like this for soldiers during the Civil War. Sometimes they might get a letter saying their child or wife died from disease. Or sometimes it was the other way around. Again, Park Ranger Melinda Day.
Today, you know, UPS rolls up to our door. That makes us happy at Christmas time because we think joy is wrapped up inside of a box. But during the Civil War, it's going to be Adams Express that might send you a notice in the mail that you have a package waiting down at the depot and you need to get down there and pick it up. Well, it's your son's pocket watch. It's a small Bible that he carried in his pocket. Maybe it's a pocket knife that you gave him one Christmas long ago. Now you're getting it back. It's the reverse effect. There is no joy in this, but that's a Christmas of 1864.
Still, the soldiers stationed in Harper's Ferry in 1864 tried to make merry as best they could, even if some of them were far away from home at Christmas.
Oh, we'll rally round the flag, boys, we'll rally once again, shouting the battle cry of freedom. We will rally.
For Inside Appalachia, I'm Liz McCormick in Harper's Ferry.
Shouting the battle cry of freedom. The Union forever, hurrah, boys, hurrah. Down with the traitor and up with the star, while we rally.
That story won a Murrow for Best Use of Sound and was selected as the best radio feature for the Two Virginias by the Associated Press. West Virginia Public Broadcasting recently won 7 of 11 awards from the Regional Associated Press and 6 Regional Murrows. This show highlighted just a few of the winners. You know, it's overwhelming sometimes to think of the responsibility with being a broadcaster or producer. But as we celebrate these awards, we're really celebrating the people and these stories. We also want to remember Edward R. Murrow and his cautionary speech about electronic media called Wires and Lights in a Box. I think his words still ring true.
Our history will be what we make it. And if there are any historians about 50 or 100 years from now, and there should be preserved the kinescopes for 1 week of all 3 networks, They will there find recorded in black and white, or perhaps in color, evidence of decadence, escapism, and insulation from the realities of the world in which we live. I am entirely persuaded that the American public is more reasonable, restrained, and more mature than most of our industry's program planners believe. Their fear of controversy is not warranted by the evidence. I have reason to know, as do many of you, that when the evidence on a controversial subject is fairly and calmly presented, the public recognizes it for what it is, an effort to illuminate rather than to agitate. This instrument can teach, it can illuminate, yes, and even it can inspire. But it can do so only to the extent that humans are determined to use it to those ends. Otherwise, it's nothing but wires and lights in a box.
That was Edward R. Murrow in 1958. You can find a link to the full speech on our website at wvpublic.org. Here on Inside Appalachia, we take pride in giving voice to the voiceless. And at times, that means folks without money or power. But those stories matter. We hope this show is truly about the often harsh realities of our communities, while celebrating our strength and victories. Till next week, thanks for joining me as we journey throughout Appalachia. Music in today's show was provided by Anna and Elizabeth, Andy Agnew Jr., Ben Townsend, Jake Sheps, and Dinosaur Burps. Our producer is Roxy Todd. Today's show was edited by Glennis Ward. Our audio mixer is Xander Alloy. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at feedback at wvpublic.org. Find us on Twitter at InAppalachia or at Jessica Y. Lilly. You can also address your letters to Inside Appalachia in care of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and at wvpublic.org. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.